We are back. Back and better than ever. Okay. Welcome to Scary Dad Podcast, episode 137. It is July 1st, 2019. We're about halfway through the year. Exactly. And it's been a couple weeks. What you been up to, man?
Just work. Work, that's about it, man. Just staying busy and recruiting and getting stuff ready for the Scary Dad Haunted Halloween Show Part 3.
Yeah, that's that's grown quite significantly since we started it. Part 3 has grown significantly since we started it. So, yeah, we'll have a little bit more detail on that coming soon. This episode's going to be a little bit backwards.
New business is new business, and this is new business.
Thank you, Mr. Gomez. Hit it with the new business, bro, because the episode this time is going to be
all about old business.
Dude, we got a whole episode of old business to discuss, and it's not because we've been gone for a while. All this stuff happened on July 1st, so, but it's a lot of interesting, cool stuff. So,
okay. All right. Go ahead and get started.
I was just...
A three-year-old in San Antonio recently got the attention of Mr. Jordan Peele. Okay, I don't know if you read about this, but this three-year-old, she had a birthday party, and she chose the theme. And the theme she chose was The Nun. And it is so creepy looking. Here are some of the pictures from this little girl's birthday party. But she went all out with her own costume as the nun. And like I said, it actually caught the attention of Mr. Jordan Peele, who tweeted out to her asking if she already has a godfather. Because he was willing to volunteer to be this sweet little girl's godfather. So I thought that was pretty cool. She dressed up as the nun. She had a pinata in the shape of the nun. And it was just the creepiest three-year-old you've seen in a while, for sure.
Have you seen or heard anything about Toy Story 4?
I've heard some about it, but
we saw it last week when it came out. Mm-hmm. I really enjoyed it. It was a good movie. Everybody's opinions are what they are, but I enjoyed it. But perhaps the best part is Key and Peele play two new characters.
Okay, yeah, I did hear about that.
And they're hilarious. Absolutely just... I didn't realize it was them watching the movie. Uh-huh. I sat, and like, I was like, I recognized the voices, but I couldn't just place it. And I went, you know, like, the credits were rolling. I was like, oh!
That's
great.
You know, what's interesting is I saw the other day on the Texas Frightmare group, somebody was talking about the movie Us. And this one, you know how you always get negative comments about stuff. Mm-hmm. This one guy started the argument that Jordan Peele needs to stick to comedy because he's a comedian. And it brought me back to our episode where we talked about there's a lot of similarities between comedy and horror. And mm-hmm. one of the things is timing. It's all about timing and stuff. Yeah, but so Jordan Peele is a pretty talented guy.
I think so. And what's funny is... he made his name, and I mean, who knows what he's going to do tomorrow? You know, he could go horror, he could go comedy, he could go, you know, he could do Robert Rodriguez and go kid movie for a while. You know, like whatever right. he wants to do, he's pretty much Hollywood's number one guy right now, right? But he is hilarious. He's good at making scary movies. So keep your comments to yourself.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. Like, yeah, his argument was like any old school horror fan sees that he's not very good at his movies. It only appeals to, and I'm like, no. give the guy his due. I mean,
no, we've discussed it before. It's like when you look back at the Stephen King movie, you know, filmography, and it's like, okay, well, none of them are going to stand up to the books. First of all, fair enough. All of them are going to be a Cliff Notes version, but look at the directors they had, you know, between John Carpenter and Cronenberg mm-hmm. and like all these different guys. Like, what do you want? Like, what do you want out of a production team? You know, like, you want them to make a movie, and then they do make a movie, and then you're like, it's like, okay, well, That's cool though. The little nun, little girl.
Awesome, dude. Okay. You know, we always find stupid research studies that get presented that make us harken back to the days when things were just, you know, just happened. There wasn't any kind of bad connotation to some of the things we grew up loving. Well, a new research study coming from a Canadian Society of Researchers is making the argument that dodgeball is not just a harmless children's game, but actually a sinister activity that teaches them oppression.
Of course it does.
So they there will be a meeting in Vancouver where they're going to present their ideas, arguing that the game of dodgeball is miseducative because it basically makes kids learn that they should be oppressing weaker people.
Move faster.
Joy Butler, who's a professor of curriculum at the University of British Columbia, in her abstract says, we consider the potential of physical education to empower students by engaging them in critical and democratic practices. We conclude that the hidden curriculum offered by dodgeball is antithetical to this project, even when it reflects the choices of the strongest and most agile students. It's dodgeball, dude. Mm-hmm. It's a rite of passage for most kids.
Okay, so I want to jump in here and point something out. I probably pointed it out on the show before. And it's this kind of like weird, like, social lines drawn across belief and values, right? So what you'll find, and this comment is not making a case for either thing, but what you will find is typically the more religious, faithful people have a tendency to lean against concepts like evolution and natural selection. Mm-hmm. And your more liberal, you're more atheistic, less believing, less faithful type people tend to lean more into the science aspect and more towards the evolution and stuff. But then, like, all of these scientists and all of these sociologists, they all kind of lean in that science direction too, and then spit right in the face of evolution. It's like, no, natural selection means that some people thrive and some don't.
Right.
And the whole game is to ensure that your genes pass on to the next generation. And not necessarily that other genes don't. You just have to be the alpha. You have to be, like, and that's male or female.
Right.
You ensure that your genes pass on to the next generation and into the future. There is nothing more basic than a children's game that teaches children skills and how to be a little bit more assertive and dominant and avoid getting raspy. That's relatively safe. and
the rules are simple
and sanctioned. You know, you can put a bunch of organisms into a controlled environment and see which ones come out on top, and nobody dies. It's perfect. It's a petri dish, really.
Right.
But yet everybody wants to quash it. There's no kids can't have fun.
Yeah, this researcher really, you know, is trying to get more into what dodgeball actually is than a simple game that's been around for, you know, decades.
Ever.
Yeah. According to her, the dodgeball reinforces the five faces of oppression. These were originally defined by the late University of Chicago social and political theorist Iris Marion Young. They identify three of those faces involved in dodgeball, which are marginalization, powerlessness, and helplessness. Of those perceived as weaker individuals through the exercise of violence and dominance by those who are considered more powerful. If anything, to me, what it teaches is for the weaker ones, and, you know, the ones it teaches them, you know, this is what you need to do to get out of that funk. You know, You got to work to get away from that. So now dodgeball is,
or you get smart and get yourself a hit first, then you can go sit on the side and not play. Like, didn't you ever do that when you didn't feel good? Like, I just don't feel like playing right now. So you, boom, take a ball and go sit down.
Okay, I'm sure you probably heard about this already, but the second season of Haunting of Hill House is in the works right now.
Mm-hmm.
The Victoria Pedretti, who was in the original Haunting of Hill House, she played Nell. She will be returning to this new one, and the new season is going to be entitled The Haunting of Bly Manor. Haunting of Bly Manor is inspired by Henry James's Psychological gothic horror novella, The Turn of the Screw, which takes place almost entirely in an old country mansion. There, two young orphans are looked after by a young governess by whom most of the story is narrated. And Pedretti will be playing the lead role of the governess. So nice. We got that to definitely look forward to. We were big fans of that show for sure. And can't wait to
see this next one. It's funny because I haven't seen that show, you know, for all, you know, whatever. But whenever you're like, oh, she played Nell, like, I immediately got sad. Like, that was such a tragic story, dude. It's so good. Hill House, if you haven't seen it, you need to. It's amazing.
Okay, this is a story that I found interesting. I thought would make for a good discussion. You know, I've talked about before how, you remember, just shows in the 80s and the 90s for the most part, they don't have them as often now as they used to, but you'd see a sitcom where somebody would suddenly develop amnesia. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they would like freak out at people walking up to them and they're like, who are you? And all this other stuff. Well, in Baton Rouge, a woman named Kim Denicola, she had an accident, and all of a sudden she was on the phone with her husband. She was leaving a Bible study, and she called her husband, let her know she was leaving. All of a sudden she said she had an intense headache, blurry vision, and she passed out. She was taken to an emergency room and everything, woke up, and this woman has lost 30 years of memories. To her, it is 1980, and she is an 18-year-old person.
Really?
She has no memories of her children, her grandchildren, her husband, nothing. And apparently this is a known condition. Illness, a condition that comes upon people, but normally it takes a few days and the memories come back. This woman is going on like months, and she still cannot remember anything. Her last memory is from 1980.
Is she building new ones? Like, she can remember what happened this week?
Yes, yeah, yeah.
From so it's not, just, it's not like the Drew Barrymore in that
movie. Right, yeah, yeah. She has a 30-year gap where she doesn't recognize her own children, grandchildren, or her husband. That is just, to me...
So frightening.
Yeah, yes. When she woke up in the hospital, the nurses asked her, do you know what today is and what year it is? She said, yeah, it's 1980. And they asked her, well, who's the president? And she said, Ronald Reagan. And that's when they realized something was very, very wrong.
Wow.
What's going on with her. And a doctor came in, asked her the same series of questions. She had the same answers. When her husband came in and held her hand, she had no idea who it was. And they're doing CAT scans. They're trying to get her memory back. She doesn't remember computers. She doesn't remember flat screen TVs. All this stuff is totally new to her. Imagine how scary that would be, man.
Wow.
So, yeah, I found that... This story is just fascinating.
Now, what if, instead of it being a medical condition, what if it's one of those Mandela effects or interdimensional things where her modern mind flew back and so there's a 50-year-old woman running around in an 18-year-old body
right.
in 1980.
Right.
And she's predicting all of this stuff and people are like, this lady's crazy.
Yeah, so...
That is insane. Yeah. That's terrifying.
Yeah, I thought that was crazy. And we'll finish it off with one of our funnies.
All right.
Recent Alabama meth bust. An attack squirrel was rescued when sheriff's deputy seized meth, ammunition, and more at a North Alabama home. Okay, this guy apparently, Mickey Polk, 35 years old, had been dusting the squirrel's food with meth to make him more and more aggressive. So I'm not sure what's going to happen to the squirrel. I never saw a
follow-up. So what do you, like, point the cage at somebody and just, like, open it, and the squirrel's like, cha-cha-cha-cha.
Yeah, pretty much. The squirrel's just running after people, and kind of like the squirrel from Over the Hedge. Just imagine the squirrel from Over the Hedge just running around, just biting people and getting away real quick. And what I love is the name of said attack squirrel is D's Nuts.
Of course it would be.
Yeah, so that was Alabama man causing this one. Yeah, I thought the methed up attack squirrel was pretty crazy.
The nightmare should have been over, but true terror never dies. Friday the 13th, part 5 on USA. Thursday at 9, 8 central.
First, the old business.
All right. Well, normally, old business is a segment, but this time it's the whole show. I sat down Scott and I were like, hey, let's get together and do some shows. And I'm like, okay, we'll come up with an idea and I'll come up with one and then we'll figure it out. And then I sat down to do today's old business and it just kept coming. And I kept reading and kept clicking on links. And I ended up, the show prep that I normally do for any old, just any show at all, old business usually takes about like 10 minutes because it's like, oh, here's a few bites. Like this happened, this guy died, this one was born. This took me like 2.5 hours of just straight up reading.
Oh, wow, man.
And well, I mean, it's clicking on links and going back and being like, okay, this is something fun to talk about. So without further ado, we're going to ask Mr. Gomez to introduce the segment. And even though it's not first, well, but so we've got all kinds of cool stuff and we can talk about each individual piece. You don't have to necessarily be in, you know, in the know with the exact events, yeah. But just kind of be like, oh damn. So on this date in 1953, John Fish and Heinrich Voss were the first Lutheran martyrs burned at the stake by Catholics in the courtyard in Belgium, like the city square in Belgium, Brussels.
Uh-huh.
Dude, like, you both pretty much believe in the same thing. But, like, those guys just believe a little bit different.
So we're going to burn them.
We're going to light them up. Like, set them on fire.
Religion used to be, well, it still is to a certain extent, but it used to be really violent.
Yeah. That's rough, dude. Okay. Here's another one. 1766. So almost a little more than 200 years later. François Jean de la Barre. He's a young French nobleman, was tortured, beheaded, and his body burnt on a pyre, with Voltaire's Dictionnaire Philosophique nailed to the torso for the crime of not saluting a Roman Catholic religious procession.
Like I said, religion used to be really violent, man.
He didn't salute a procession.
So they beheaded him.
They cut him up and
burned tortured him. Tortured him, beheaded him, and then, Jesus, man.
Yeah. Frightening days, like that. So it's what, 10 o'clock in the morning here, Saturday in Houston in 2019. But in 1766, some dude was waking up this morning, probably, you know, having a cup of coffee. He's French, so he's probably like, oh, oh, oh. And then he's gonna end up the day headless, burnt, tortured,
and with a book nailed to his torso.
Think about that.
What was
the
significance of the Voltaire book?
I think he had it on him. I'm not sure.
Because I'm a big fan of Voltaire, yeah. I'll be honest with you.
He was a critic.
Yeah.
You know, he was a critic of religion, so I would assume they weren't, you know, proponents of whatever it said on the inside. And this date in 1863, talking about waking up early in the morning to get your day on. On this date in 1863, the Battle of Gettysburg begins. Turning point of the Civil War.
Right.
Also, lots and lots of people died.
Very bloody battle, yes.
And one of those things I could never quite wrap my head around was, my grandfather was a real big Civil War buff. My dad was a little bit too, not as big as my grandfather. But they look at these books and you learn about it and you look at these maps and you see these different, like, roads and railroads and this different stuff that they did, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, is a big giant field where they, you know, the Confederates were marching towards Washington and the Unions were blocking them. The Unions massed their troops and the Confederates came and met them and then they stood there and, like, punched it out. I'm like, why the hell didn't the Confederates just walk around? Just go a few miles that way.
And then double back up.
Like, you're going to lose half your arm. Like, what's the point? Like, you just... It, to me, it's like ducking a punch, right?
Yeah.
Like, I don't want to fight that guy. He's too big. I'm going to go over here and, like, see if he doesn't see me. And they're like, no, that's just not how it was done.
And I'm thinking, it all head on.
And I'm thinking, okay, well, like, that's not how it was done. Like, you've got your, like rank and file troops who are just marching to their deaths because their commanders are too stupid to go, hey, let's take the freeway with the less traffic on it.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? I'm rerouting. But yeah, on this date in 1863, what was it, like 40, 50,000 people died?
It was a significant number.
It was a lot. I can just imagine walking up, no armor, no cover, just walking up.
With muskets.
And just boom, and just standing there and taking that volley. And then all your buddies are falling down around you, and you just are lucky if you didn't get hit.
Right.
And then you shoot, and then it's their turn again, and like, what the hell? This just does not make sense. But, anyway. All right, on this date in 1874, if you like books, if you like stories, if you like people who write things, on this date in 1874, the first commercially successful typewriter goes on sale.
So it was a game changer.
Yeah. So I guess before that, it was handwritten, and then you had to send it in and have it transcribed.
Yep. Who doesn't like books? Do you know anybody that doesn't like books? I'm thinking about it right now.
I know a lot of people that are like, I can't, I don't read books. But then they read all day on their phone. So it's not like they're, like they're reading, essentially reading the newspaper.
Yeah.
If you think about it, you know, if you're reading on your phone. But yeah, I don't know. I'm like a collector and a bibliophile. So I like books, even not having read them. I just like the way they feel and
they
smell and, you know, that kind of stuff. But, you know, like all the Stephen Kings up there, I've read all of those. I probably am not going to read them again because I got so many other books to read, but they're cool.
Yeah, that's one thing. I cannot throw away a book. To me, it's just it. That's why I have so damn many right now.
Yeah.
I can't throw a book away.
Well, what's weird is every book I've ever gotten rid of, I've kind of regretted it later. Because not the ones that I loan to people, like, oh, hey, you should read this. That never bothers me. But, like, if I've put a bunch into a box and gave them to half price, inevitably, like a couple years later, I'm digging for it because I'm like, oh, dude, you need to read this. It's awesome. And then I'm like, oh, I don't have it anymore.
Yeah, I have certain books where I need to get new copies because I've always passed. The books are significant to me, and I know other people can benefit from reading them. So I've always given them away and then just get another copy later. Voltaire is one of those. Candide by Voltaire is one of those books that I've given away many, many times.
Yeah, there's a lot of them like that. Like, what's the... I got that Sandman from you, like that first series of the individual books. But I have the graphic novel, the collected versions that I've read myself like four or five times, and I've let other people read it, and it's dog-eared, and I mean, but that's the one that I would think that if I was to be able to meet Gaiman, that's probably the one I'd have signed, because that's the one that's been carried around with me through. You know, I've had it for like 25 years, right. You know.
Speaking of Gaiman, did you hear the thing with American Gods where...
Amazon?
Yeah.
It was for Good Omens.
Is that what it was? Yeah, it was for Good Omens.
Which American Gods is so much worse.
But they requested that Netflix stop, shut the series down. So Netflix was right, sure, we'll go ahead and stop. It's not on Netflix. It's on Amazon. I thought that was hilarious.
that was hilarious. Like, I follow him on Twitter or whatever. He's like, dude, you can't write this stuff.
the replies by Netflix and Amazon were just hilarious.
That was great.
You know, Netflix saying, hey, Amazon, if you stop Stranger Things, we'll stop Good Omens. It was hilarious. Made for great.
Okay. On this date in 1881, the first international telephone call happened. When I was writing this down, I thought about that when Homer was staying in Mr. Burns' place and making long-distance phone calls just to see what they sounded like. He's like, oh, hey, some accent you got there. You always talk like that. You just call up like, hey, is your refrigerator running? Okay, let's see. On this date in 1903, the first Tour de France, which was not a big deal until Lance Armstrong rode
it. That's when it gained a lot of popularity at that point.
Then after he stopped doing it, it's not a very big deal anymore.
Can you name any other Tour de France rider besides you?
So, and I really don't care about the fact that he doped. Captain America is Captain America because they gave him the Super Soldier Serum, which is essentially like magic steroids, and everybody loves him.
When I look at that story, some of the stories to me, it's he just happens to be the one that got caught.
Oh yeah,
because I can promise you, he's not the only one.
Oh, and he got sold. He got sold out. Well, that's what's so bad is like, you know, like the people who are selling him out. It's like, oh, there's this big network of dopers and you know. There's the people who take the dope. There's the people who administer the dope. There's the people who prescribe the dope. There's the people who procure the dope. And you've got like these millions of people and everybody's involved. Yet that one guy is the one who falls and everybody yep. else just kind of... back just, into the yeah.
And that's all it is. He's just the one that got caught. He's yeah. not the only one that was doing it. So
he's high profile. They wanted to bring him down.
Yeah. I think that's what made him so loved by Americans is that he was pissing everybody else off.
Yeah.
You know, because Americans have that ego.
Whatever, dude. He lied about it. But I mean, it's not like you're an inspiration for kids. Yeah, you know, like imagine if a whole bunch of kids like thought he could do that off steroids and they like try real, real hard.
And they never accomplish.
Well, what if they do?
Yeah.
And otherwise they wouldn't have. So whatever. All right, on this date in 1908, SOS is adopted as the International Distress Signal. I don't know what it was before.
Everybody had their own.
I guess everybody had their own. It's like you go to Canada and try to dial 911 and it don't work. It's like, but I don't know what they organized rocks onto beaches back then for passing planes, but I guess, you know, they didn't have planes. So. Well, no, in 1908 they did, so maybe that's why they needed to do that.
Yeah.
Because all these people were writing SOS on the beach and the plane pilots were like, what the hell are we talking about? All right. In 1963, zip codes are introduced for mail.
Yeah, that seems fairly recent for that. I would think it'd be older than that.
I would have thought so, too. It never occurred to me. Like, I would have thought that zip codes would have been around since the postal service.
Beginning of the postal service, right.
You know, like, okay, where are we taking these? Over there, like, to the west, you know? Like. But, yeah, I thought that's...
Yeah, that's an odd one.
That's very recent. Okay, game changer here. 1979, Sony introduces the Walkman. Remember your first Walkman?
Yeah, yeah, very well.
Remember, they had the name, it was like Xerox. Like, I'm going to go make some copies, I'm going to go Xerox some copies. Yep. You know, Sony had the thing on the Walkman because even if you had a non-Sony tape player headphone thing, it was still called a Walkman.
You still called it a Walkman, right.
And if you had a Sony Walkman... You call it a Sony Walkman, right? Like, those are my memories of kids. Like, oh, what'd you get for Christmas? I got a Sony Walkman, you know? But, yeah. I don't remember my first Walkman. Because my dad worked at Radio Shack, and so he got non-Sony ones.
Okay.
My last one was that yellow one, like the sports
store. Yeah, yeah. It had like anti-shock on it and everything.
It had auto reverse.
Bumpers on it and stuff.
Yeah, and I don't know what happened to that. Like, I don't remember ever getting rid of it, but I'm like...
Well, the Discman came out next. You had to...
Well, even so, you couldn't really use the Discman because they skip.
Yeah, but then they came out with anti-skip.
But it didn't work.
I know. Anti-skip and bass boost were the biggest...
Yeah.
The dumbest,
I had a really nice Discman with anti-skip, and it skipped like crazy. You know, I mean, I had like these little modular speakers that would connect to it. But the Walkman, so you'd buy your CD, you'd tape it, and then play it on the Walkman right. because the Walkman didn't skip. And so you could walk with it.
Right.
Throw it in your backpack or whatever.
Did you ever have the cassette player adapter for the car?
Oh, yeah.
To this Discman?
Oh, of course. That was so cool whenever they started doing the aux cable on car radios that you could just plug in your Walkman or your Discman to it.
Right.
But, yeah, it was... God, remember all the stuff? I mean, I guess stock car stereos are so good these days. Like, my GMC outside has a Bose system inside of it. So nobody's really doing aftermarket stereos anymore unless you're competing or something.
Yeah, they
God, do you remember those, like, the ones that would, like, when you turned off your car, it would flip the face?
Yeah.
It would, like, so that people wouldn't steal it.
Anti-theft stuff, right.
But then people would look in there and be like, oh, it's a blank face. It's that's a high-end Alpine. I'm taking it.
Removable faces, too.
The removable faces.
Yeah, I had one of those.
Yeah, everybody had one of those. Then what I figured out, because I had this old truck and I got my stereo stolen out of it, somebody ripped the stereo, was I went to, I guess, Lynch Radio Shack, and I bought the cheapest AM FM radio that I could find. Had a little tape player on it.
Uh-huh.
Put that in there and connected it, and then I could use my adapter and listen to my Discman.
Right.
So if you put the Discman on the seat, it didn't skip. That's how high-tech we were back in the
90s. Car stereo, just technology used to be. I remember we used to get those Crutchfield magazines that you could order stuff from. And I remember when they came out with the, it was the disc changer where you had like a cartridge you could put 10 CDs in, and then it looked like a VCR.
Yeah, basically. And it's a trunk.
Yeah, you put it in your trunk. That's the thing. You're limited to those 10 CDs unless you pulled over, popped it out, and reloaded the new cartridge. But yeah, those used to be the shit.
Oh, hell yeah. All right. I don't know why it's relevant, but I thought it was funny because of the recency effect. On this date in 1980, O Canada becomes the first the official national anthem of Canada. 1980? Where have you been?
Yeah. What was it before? Or did they even have one before?
I don't know. Like, you've heard that, like, everybody wanted to lynch Ripley. Because he revealed that the Star Spangled Banner was not the official national anthem. It had been used ceremonially, but it was not, like, officially recognized by the government. When he pointed that out in a Ripley's Believe It or Not, people got pissed. And they were writing in. They were, like, telling him he was some kind of communist or weirdo or whatever. He's like,
I'm just letting you guys know.
So the Congress, like, made a quick act to, like, actually incorporate it and make it official. But this was, like, that was back in, like, the 60s or 70s or something. And that was, like, an administrative oversight. Like, everybody assumed it was.
Mm-hmm.
Like, everybody had been, you know, oh, it's our national anthem. He's like, actually, it's not technically true. And they're like, oh, well, we'll fix that. But O Canada, like, I guess maybe the same thing.
Yeah.
Maybe they just were too busy punching elks or something to care. And drinking what's a Canadian beer? Molson?
Molson, yes.
Molson and drinking Crown Royal.
You know, I listen to the Trailer Park Boys podcast, and they actually, every once in a while, they'll do, you know, facts about Canada and stuff. And it's I'd love to visit Canada just to check it out. One of the craziest facts that I saw is, and I remember the Bare Naked Ladies song, If I Had $1 Million?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Boxes of Kraft macaroni and cheese, actually, they read Kraft Dinner in Canada. And Canada consumes more Kraft Dinner than any other country in the world. Did you know that?
I did not know that.
They love their Kraft Dinner, dude. And they don't call it Kraft mac and cheese. It's Kraft Dinner.
Wow.
And that's what the boxes actually say up there that they send to Canada. But yeah, Canada consumes more Kraft Dinner than anybody else. And I've noticed on shows like Corner Gas. I don't know if you watch Corner Gas. I highly recommend it. It's on Amazon Prime. There's like, I want to say there's 8 or 9 seasons of it, but it's just a half-hour comedy show about a corner gas station in Canada. It is the guy, Brett, I can't remember his last name, but he stars in it and he wrote the show. It's awesome, dude. Corner Gas, and it's family-friendly. You don't have to worry about not watching it. It's not like Trailer Park Boys where there's tons of cursing and stuff. It's a family-friendly comedy, but it's won tons of awards. It's considered the greatest comedy ever in Canada. It's like up there with, it's up there with Seinfeld.
Okay.
It'd be like Seinfeld in Canada. But yeah, they talk about Kraft Dinner all the time. And now I know why, because they eat more Kraft Dinner than anybody else.
You're making me want to watch Strange Brew.
I got that DVD. I might check that out. I love that movie, man.
Dude. Somebody posted just a clip of them doing it on Saturday Night Live, or what it was,
Rick, Second
it
was City,
SC, but it was Rick Moranis.
Yeah,
and,
I can't remember his name.
Dave, same as the Wendy's guy.
Thomas.
Dave Thomas, and they're sitting there talking about how, like, oh, this guy found a mouse in a beer.
Yeah,
it was like that skit, and I sat there, dude. I was crying. I was laughing so hard.
They were awesome
because he's like, how to get the mouse in the beer is you put him in when he's really little.
Yeah, like feed him until he grows. Feed him until he grows. That's what they did. Yeah, we found a mouse in your beer, yay? And we're told we can get a free case.
Yeah, so you're going to go through all that trouble to raise a mouse in a beer. And then Rick Moranis is sitting there trying to figure out how many
bottles are in a case.
It's so cool. And they're just like so just bizarrely, but they're so funny. Like, they're just... Anyway, I love Rick Moranis, period, but the way he just... It's like effortlessly funny.
Yeah.
It's like he's kind of the straight man and the funny man at the same time. He's just...
His ability to get into a character is just phenomenal, dude.
It's awesome. All right, and this date in 1984... The MPAA sets the PG-13 rating on movies. What was the first PG-13?
That I don't know. I couldn't.
Well, because of Gremlins and Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, people were pissed. Because it wasn't enough to rate it R, but it wasn't. It also wasn't like...
Very borderline.
Yeah. It was actually Red Dawn.
Okay.
The first PG-13. Which, if you want to get into brass tacks, Red Dawn's like possibly worse than the other two because it's realistic, right? So
it was nightmare fuel back then.
Dude. Oh, totally. Man. I was terrified of Red Dawn. But Red Dawn doesn't have a tremendous amount of blood. You know, it's like the kind of triggers that trigger.
Yeah, there's a lot of deaths, but it's not gory.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's very bleak. There's a lot of deaths and there's a lot of horrific scenes, but it's not like Gremlins where it's like, you know. But yeah, Red Dawn, first PG-13. And did you know? Because when I was reading this, I was like, that's interesting. So I kind of clicked the history of the MPAA ratings. And there was no MPAA ratings until Night of the Living Dead. Night of the Living Dead was rated G when it came out. and ratings were actually imposed by the Chicago police union. So they'd watch, you know, they'd say, okay, it's... So basically what you had was you had general audiences or not rated, like not viewed or whatever. And so the X rating was for anything that was not G rated. It was like either...
It's one or the other.
It was either out for consumption, or it wasn't rated, or not for kids, or whatever. The X rating did not mean pornography until later.
Yeah.
X was like kind of like rated R, or even PG. It was like either everybody can go see it, or some people shouldn't, and you know, you should make your own decision, but be warned. Uh-huh. Then, whenever they actually came out with restricted audiences, the rated R. And rated X, well, X was just not rated. X was just kind of like off the map. So you had G, PG, and R. And R, nobody under 16 was admitted. X, nobody under 16 was admitted. But they wouldn't show X-rated movies because they couldn't get the distribution. There was like, they weren't getting paid. The studios wouldn't push down X-rated movies. Then pornography movies started coming out and just kind of
took over the X.
They basically brought the X onto themselves. They're like, hey, we're an X-rated show. And so they started to open up like the little porn theaters and stuff, and the X-rated would go in that direction. But then later on you'd have some movies that were too much for an R rating.
Like Faces of Death or something.
Something like that. Not like that. It was like Henry and June was the first NC-17, because you had some movies that were they were mainstream dramatic stories. They were not pornography, but whether it was sex, violence, or gore, or whatever else, they couldn't get an R rating. Mm-hmm. Kind of like what zombies always working against.
Yeah.
They got an X rating and they couldn't get distribution on it. So then the MPAA changed that to NC-17. Nobody under 17 can see this movie. Right. Then X got moved to 18. So somehow there's a year in there. between being able to see boobs and being able to see, you know, whatever. But it's really weird how it evolved, because the people who legislate your morality, right, basically can't figure out what porn is. It's what really the long story, you know, like the long and the short.
Because NC-17 has kind of disappeared, hasn't it?
It kind of has.
Yeah.
Well, especially with the advent of digital media. A lot of distribution channels don't care anymore if you get an R, or if they don't get rated. So, that, I mean, now, like, you and I go out, we make a movie, and the process of getting it MPAA rated is expensive and mm-hmm. arduous. You throw it up on YouTube, it's not rated, so we don't care. I'm not gonna go through a big... I mean, it's the studio movies that worry about the ratings.
Right, for distribution purposes.
Yeah, and an indie film, like, if you might have something... I mean, obviously, Blair Witch is, you know, 20 years old. But, like, Blair Witch, independent film, put out on an indie label, probably, I think it was unrated when it came out, and then it got an R rating later. Mm-hmm. So, but it was an indie film. It was an indie... phenomenon that went into the mainstream, not the other way around. So, all right, notable births. See, I told you there was a lot. Yeah. So, notable births on this date, 1906. Estée Lauder. Estée Lauder is the person that I was telling you about that one time. It's like, I just assumed she was that there was a brand. I didn't realize that was a person.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I'm like, I remember when she died, it was like, oh, that was a person.
That was a person.
Like, oh, okay. Well, on this date in 30. Yeah, I had two mixed up. This date in 1930, Mustafa Akkad was born. He was the main producer of the Halloween franchise.
Okay.
He was the producer. He's the one that brought Michael Myers and John Carpenter into the mainstream.
Okay.
He financed the first movie and all the subsequent ones. So he died in a terrorist bombing in Jordan in 2005. So, pretty crazy.
Yeah.
On this date in 1935, David Prowse was born. The Darth Vader.
Yes, yeah.
Lots of other characters, but most notable.
Darth Vader.
This date in 1939, Karen Black was born. She was Mama Firefly in House of Thousand Corpses.
And a lot of other
films. Yeah, that's tangentially closest to what we're talking about. And this date in 1945, Blondie was born, Debbie Harry. So, big pop icon. She was the first rap song.
Yeah, I was about to say, she started rap back in the day with Flavor Flav dancing in the background. I don't remember that part of that video, but Flavor Flav's in that video.
All right, let's see. 1952, Dan Aykroyd.
Good. Awesome, awesome guy.
Want to see something really scary? Good stuff. All right, 1961, Olympian Carl Lewis. He was a big deal for a while.
Yep, very much so.
Also in 1961, Princess Diana, Lady Di. 1967, Pamela Anderson. Remember her in the 90s? That was like huge.
Oh, yeah.
I was like, she is so hot. I was like, she was real hot before she like blew herself up and... like she like inflated her lips and inflated her boobs and her hair went white and like it's like whoa. she was just like a cute little blonde chick on Tool Time and then
what was that movie she did where she was like a that action movie Barbed Wire.
Wasn't she also Stripperella?
I think so, and she was also Borat's love interest.
All right, notable deaths. On this date in 1860, Charles Goodyear. Famous for a blimp and a tire.
Yeah.
He started the Goodyear Rubber Company, basically. 1995, we lost Wolfman Jack. 1997, Robert Mitchum.
Oh.
That's a heavy hitter right there. 2000, 2000, Walter Matthau.
That's another one. He was a big part of the 80s, 70s and 80s.
Yeah. 2004, Marlon Brando.
Another big one.
Big one. And a couple weeks ago, we were staycation. We were at a hotel. And just kind of, okay, we don't have any kids. And what do we want to do? And it's hot. And let's just chill. We sat in a hotel and watched Godfather on like TBS. Came in like an hour into it. Watched it for 2 hours. And there was still like an hour to go. But you forget. Well, nobody ever forgets how great The Godfather is. You forget how many pop culture references there are in The Godfather that people just say things and you don't. It doesn't occur to you that it's
from The Godfather.
But then they'll say it and you're like, you know. But yeah, I started noticing all the oranges. Like you've seen that, where it's like every time there's an orange in a scene, that person's going to die. Not necessarily in the next scene, but pretty close to it. And they're pretty prevalent once you start paying attention. And then in 2005, Luther Vandross.
My first concert.
Really?
Somebody posted the other day asking, you know, what was your first concert? My first concert was Luther Vandross with Key Sweat opening.
Wow.
I'll never forget. I was in the ninth grade.
That's historical right there.
That was the first major concert that I went to. And I remember that was during my Al B. Shore phase where I had the little pencil thin mustache and I would wear denim with a matching denim jacket and a white t-shirt.
Nice. Hell yeah, bro.
But I wore that out. I remember the outfit I wore to it and everything. It was at the Cajun Dome in Lafayette, Louisiana.
It's weird because, you know, the pendulum swings. My first non-parental concert was Aerosmith with Megadeth.
Okay.
So that was like in like 93. I was like 16, 17, something like that. But before that was the Beach Boys. And Dad, you know, I'd seen several bands with my folks and stuff. But seeing the Beach Boys at the, wherever it was, at the Summit, I think it was, which is Lakewood Church now. And it was interesting to say the least. Like, I mean, I'm a kid, I'm sort of like music lover or whatever. And my dad always liked the Beach Boys. I liked them too. But to see those guys in like four-part harmony while they're playing instruments at the same time, it's like, wow. I was playing guitar at the time. Those guys are really good.
The Beach Boys, honestly, in my opinion, don't get the amount of credit they deserve for the impact they had on the music industry.
No, and for how good they actually were at music itself.
Yeah, everything. Songwriting, just everything. The Beach Boys are actually fucking phenomenal.
They really are.
And like I said, they just don't, for some reason, just my memories, and I've learned all this since then, but you know, my memories of the Beach Boys was just kind of a campy little group that, you know, had a gimmick.
Yeah.
But they were so much more than that, dude.
Well, and I think too,
Brian Wilson is just...
Well, yeah, he's a tortured genius, you know. I think too, because what happened was when you had the Beach Boys were, if there was a big three, say, you know, so you had the Beach Boys, or the Beatles, the Stones, and the Beach Boys kind of running hit radio at the same time. The Beach Boys were kind of more California surf, whereas the Beatles and the Stones were kind of more global.
Yeah.
Kind of a little bit more I don't want to say mainstream, but just a little bit more serious, so to speak, in the themes of their songs and stuff. That's the only thing I can think of, because whenever you actually look at the musicianship, I mean, you listen to the Beach Boys and you listen to the way that they sound, realize that that's like four guys singing different harmonies together. Like, that's barbershop quartet, but they're also playing instruments.
Yeah.
You know, like, that's tough. They're really good. And we got there from Luther, but it's like talking first concerts. But how was that show? You said you were dressed. How was it?
Oh, it was awesome, dude. I saw, you know, Keith Sweat was going to be, you know, a huge star when I saw him. That was in 1987, I think. 86 or 87, something like that. And that was just me and my cousin. I won tickets on a radio show.
Nice.
And it was a phenomenal concert, man. it was awesome. Like I said, Keith Sweat opened it up. A lot of people didn't know who he was at the time, and it was cool.
Yeah, my buddy John was at a Bon Jovi concert that Guns N' Roses was opening for. And he's like, yeah, that was amazing.
I remember that tour. I was in the ninth grade when that tour came around, because I remember there was a girl I came back to school the next day, and she had actually ended up backstage, and somebody had gave her a jacket from Guns N' Roses. I don't remember who it was she was with, but she was wearing her jacket the next day. 14 years old.
Damn.
But yeah, everybody was just talking about Guns N' Roses after that.
Oh yeah, huge. Have you seen the movie The Dirt?
No.
The Motley Crue story on Netflix?
No.
It's good. Okay, you need to watch that shit. It's fun.
They were some wild guys, man.
Dude. Well, it's funny.
I remember the Behind the Music scene about them.
But that show is good. It's really toned down from reality. But then watch that, and then we watch Bohemian Rhapsody, and it's like so tame. Like,
yeah.
Like even with Queen, for, you know, Freddie Mercury was an animal. You know, like he was rock star extraordinaire, and he was sexual Tyrannosaurus, and he's, you know, he's larger than life. But Queen themselves were very professional, mm-hmm. very meticulous, very, they were composers. They were a very serious band, and took themselves very seriously. And so when you watch Bohemian Rhapsody, it's like, oh, well, you know, it's like we're crazy rock stars. It's like, no, Freddie was a crazy rock star. You guys were all pretty much nerds. You watch The Dirt, you're like, this is some crazy rock star action.
Well, I remember Nick Swartzen talking about how, you know, everybody thinks they can party, and they party until you watch a Behind the Music on somebody like Motley Crue or Pantera or something, and you realize you don't know how to party.
Yeah, you'd be asleep in 10 minutes. You'd be done. All right, well, that does it for this episode of Old Business, one of our longer ones, actually, interestingly enough. So,
good conversation.
Yep, we're going to leave you here, and we will see you next week with more notes from the scary part of the internet. We'll talk to you later on.
Later.